grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the Dudes and Beer Podcast, episode 320 tonight. Guest that I have been looking so forward to since episode 300, actually, since before 300. We were supposed to have him on episode 300, and then, well, you know, the world of COVID and how that works, that everything just kind of fell apart with it, so we scheduled this at his first convenience, and we are so happy to welcome back author and researcher Graham Phillips to the show. Tonight, we will be talking about his search for the Staff of Moses, as well as his amazing book, Templars in the Ark of the Covenant. We will be talking about some of the possibilities of the fate of the Ark of the Covenant. Did it come here to America? Is it possibly sitting at the bottom of Oak Island, as some people might think? And the money pit there. Is it in Africa? So we'll be getting into some of that. Before we do, let's go ahead and get into the Dudes and Beer news of the week real quick. If you hop on over the Dudes and Beer Facebook page, that's where you can find all of our articles, all of our promotions for episodes, things like that. Coming out of Politico today, judge orders release of DOJ memo justifying not prosecuting former President Trump. Out of ABC News Go, a decision to suspend Donald Trump's Facebook account will happen this week. Coming out of CBS News, of course, is the still horrifying news about the things going on in India. The numbers there are staggering with COVID. They are clocking 120 people an hour dying in India. Canadian diplomats say the government is withholding information on Havana syndrome cases. Anybody remember that? Because they said in that sonic weapons didn't exist whenever they first started going into that. Yet still there are reports about sonic weapon attacks going on at the White House here in the last week. Bill Gates will have to wait a little while to block out the sun, apparently, according to Popular Mechanics. Our former guest, Dave Brody, posted a great image of the artifact that he was at, the big boulder that he was going to check out in the Hudson Valley. So go check that out on the Dudes and Beer group. While you're online there, make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com. That is where you can download our free app, coming soon to you, Orchard Dwellers. Right now it is Android only, but that's where you can tune into the show live. That's where you can actively come on, do all kinds of fun stuff, chat, leave questions for guests. There's a connection to our voicemail. There's even a tip calculator on there, as well as the knowledge vault, all the declassified documents, things like that. So stop on by, check that out. Dudesandbeer.com is the website. Make sure to stop on by there. And while you're there, check out True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is based right here in Austin, Texas. They are makers of some of the finest CBD products I have ever tried. I myself am a user of their products. I love their CBD toothpicks. Just something to kind of throw in your mouth if you're a nervous Nelly like me, a leg bouncer, you know, always chewing on some gum, something like that. These are great. CBD was recommended to me by my doctor for my anxiety a while back, and I've been using it for a while. And traveling all over the country, these guys have been my go-to, and they're right here in my hometown, and I love it. I typically start the day with one of their gummies. Their gummies are fantastic. Stop on by today. TrueHempScience.com is the website. The code that you want to use on your way out the door is DUDES7 to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And you will also get two, count them, two 25 milligram edibles, either brownie or cookie. So stop on by True Hemp Science today. And of course, while you are there, make sure to stop on by Podcast Cadet. Let's hear a message from them right now. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything.
When the man was dug up about 3-4 feet down, we uncovered a brass casket, again, heavily encrusted with years of silt and sediment. And inside was a small green stone about, 3/4 of an inch long, 1/2 inch wide, rounded on the one side, flat on the other, clearly once set in a ring. And it was made from simple jade. So that was a pretty impressive kind of adventure we'd gone on. And that's what got me into investigating historical mysteries with a difference.
And to know even the greenstone was the first thing that I had you on about. Because you had, I believe it had just been the anniversary of the release of the book, correct?
That's right. Yeah, right. And it would happen in 1979. So that would be 2019.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember just being flabbergasted by this story and the aftermath that happened after you found the stone. That went on at the headquarters and things like that was just phenomenal. I think I sent that book to probably about 10 people. I was just so blown away by it. And your style of writing you have a great way of breaking down a mass amount of data into a very common sense and commonly worded way, Graham. Let's start down the road of the search for the staff of Moses. That is probably hands down, at least according to all texts regarding it, things like that, probably what would be considered one of the most, quote, powerful artifacts in humankind. What was it that led you down that road?
Well, I'd already written a few books about biblical mysteries and like the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail, all items associated with biblical mysteries. And I thought, well, what's another item that's mentioned in the Bible or from ancient Christian or Judaic history that, you know, that hasn't been found? And the staff of Moses was something that jumped out at me because I thought, well, look at it this way. The Holy Grail is supposed to cure ills, perhaps in some cases make people live for a long time. The Ark of the Covenant is supposed to be, according to Indiana Jones anyway, a radio for talking to God or some kind of supernatural weapon that can blast enemy armies. Well, the staff of Moses, according to the Old Testament, is the, I don't know what to call it, a weapon, the artifact he uses to bring down or summon the 10 plagues of Egypt and to part the Red Sea. So I thought, well, there's an artifact. Now, what I want, just out of interest, I wasn't necessarily thinking of writing a book about it. I didn't think there'd be enough. But I thought, what is supposed to have happened to it? Now, according to the Bible, Moses was once, he was, the Israelites are enslaved in Egypt. They originally came from the area of what is now Israel and parts of Jordan and Palestine. It was called Canaan back in biblical times. And sometime around about 1300 to 1350 BC, the Israelites had been captured and were made to work as slaves in Egypt. And Moses is born as an Egyptian, but because the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who isn't incidentally named in the Bible, he's just known as Pharaoh, because he is getting concerned about the growing number of Israelites and thinks there might be some kind of revolt, decides to kill all the Israelite newborn children. And Moses' mother, in order to save him, puts the baby in a little basket of bulrush, a little basket, which is presumably not a wicker basket. It's some kind of basket which is waterproof because it floats amongst the bulrushes on the banks of the Nile. So he's hidden. Now, in the story, but the Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, finds this baby and, not having a child of her own and seemingly unable to bear children, decides to adopt this child. She finds out in the end who the child's real mother is, and the mother says, yes, I'd like him brought up in better circumstances than us Israelite slaves live. So he's brought up in the royal palace.
Yeah.
As a prince, an honorary prince. Ultimately, it would seem, we're not told this in the Bible, but the way that Egyptian, the Egyptian line of succession went, it went through the daughter of the Pharaoh, the eldest daughter, and whoever he married, she married, became the new king, the new Pharaoh, which obviously led to a lot of incest. In fact, Tutankhamun seems to have married his own sister, or certainly his cousin, for example. Anyway, so Moses is brought up as a prince when presumably the princess eventually becomes queen. So he's brought up as a prince of Egypt. Now, again, according to the Old Testament, one day Moses witnesses the persecution of an Israelite slave. Knowing that he comes from an Israelite background, he is angered by this and he kills the slave master and then buries his body somewhere. The body is found, and then the Pharaoh punishes him by exiling him from Egypt. He then lives in the what's called the wilderness, which is a Sinai wilderness to the east of Egypt, in areas that now include parts of southern Israel and southern Jordan and a bit of Egypt. He lives in this desert area. He marries there. He becomes part of a family of nomadic tribespeople and becomes basically a goat herder. And one day, some 40 years after he's been exiled from Egypt, he leads his sheep to his goats, to what the Bible describes as the backside of the desert. Now, he is living in the land of Midian, and the backside, the far side of the desert from there, would put it in a land that was then called Edom, in southern Jordan. And while he's there, he goes to what is known as the Mountain of God, or Mount Horeb. And when he's there, he suddenly sees a bush burning, but without the flames consuming the bush. And from within the bush, he hears the voice of God, who tells him that he is to return to Egypt and lead the Israelites to freedom. And he kind of says, well, how can I do this? And he says, now Moses has got a staff in his hand. Now, staffs at the time, okay, you've got a staff which is for walking, but many people would carry a less sturdy staff for two reasons. One, for the use in rounding up sheep.
Yep.
And two, in some areas, as a status symbol, it would have something written on it saying, this guy's in charge of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, yeah, kind of anyway, like a swagger stick for a general or a riding crop.
For a general, yes.
Yeah.
Now, Moses has this staff in his hand, and God tells him to throw the staff on the floor, and when he does, it turns into a snake. And Moses is told he will have the power over this beast, the snake, and return to Egypt, show the Pharaoh that you have the power of God, you have the power over snakes, which I presume represent the power over Satan, and throw it on the floor, and basically the Pharaoh will be impressed. So he returns to Egypt, he goes to the Pharaoh, and he does this trick with the staff, throws it on the floor, it turns into a snake. But the Pharaoh says, well, my magicians can do that. And apparently they do exactly the same. They throw their staffs on the floor. Again, these are these staffs which are their symbol of office. They throw them on the floor. They turn into snakes. But Moses gets the upper hand because his snake gobbles up all the other ones, turns back into a snake again and says, right, I've proved my power over the Egyptian gods. My God is the best. Let the Israelites go. The Pharaoh refuses. And ultimately, Moses says, if you don't let the Israelites go, then God will bring down upon Egypt a series of devastating plagues. The Pharaoh doesn't take any notice. And then Moses uses his staff to summon the 10 plagues of Egypt. Cattle die in the fields. There's a swarm of locusts and flies. People are infested with boils all over the body. The waters of the Nile become undrinkable and turn to blood. Day becomes night, and fiery hailstones fall yep. from the heavens. And the final plague which makes the Pharaoh change his mind is that Moses gets his own back, if you like, on the Egyptians, who once killed the firstborn of all these yep. Israelite families, by making all the firstborn of the Egyptians die. And this ultimately makes the Pharaoh change his mind. The Israelites are set free. They wander east of Egypt to eventually they get to the Red Sea, where they're literally caught between the Red Sea and the army of the Pharaoh, who's since changed his mind and decided, right, we're going after them. And they're trapped, and it looks like they're all going to be slaughtered until Moses holds up his staff and summons the power of God to part the Red Sea. And the waters of the Red Sea part, the Israelites cross, and when the Pharaoh's army try to follow, the seas return and drown them. Now, this is the staff of Moses.
And the staff of Moses, I mean, once again, aside from that, was also used to bring about water while the Jews were wandering in the desert.
Now, this is the bit that actually starts to lead me to where I think the staff of Moses might have been buried, where it ultimately ended up. We're not told in the Bible what happens to the staff.
Yeah.
But if it's anything like, I mean, the thing about the early Israelites is that pretty much Moses is the person who pretty much starts the Israelite religion. Although it's Abraham who, much earlier, who starts the line of the Israelite people, it is Moses who is the first one to actually bring the laws of the Israelite God to the people.
Yeah, followed by Aaron as the first high priest. And like it follows all the way down almost through his family for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron's Moses' brother.
Yeah.
And he becomes the first high priest. And the Levites, who are the people who are seemingly the relatives of Moses and Aaron, become the priestly caste. Now, what happens to Moses ultimately? Well, the Israelites are said to reside in the desert for 40 years until they eventually conquer what is now Jericho and move into the modern area of Palestine and Israel, and ultimately conquer the whole land. But Moses doesn't live that long.
Yeah.
When he is buried, we are told in the Bible, no man knoweth to this day the whereabouts of the sepulchre, the grave of Moses. But in my opinion, if wherever he's buried, he is buried where he might have been buried with this staff. Now, the early Israelites went like modern Judaism. They had a lot of Egyptian elements within their religion. The Ark, for example, the Ark of the Covenant, this golden box around which, in which were the Ten Commandment tablets, that were carried around like a sort of portable temple through the time of the wandering in the wilderness, are almost identical to Egyptian chests called barks, very similar to ark, yep, which were carried around with holy items in them, like statues of gods. In fact, there's one found in Tutankhamun's tomb. So that's a kind of Egyptian idea. There are many other Egyptian. I mean, Judaism didn't just come about. It gradually transformed from a kind of early form of cross between the Egyptian and Hebrew religion over many years. Mm. So Moses may well have been buried, like many Egyptian high-ranking figures were, with the staff in his grave. So if I could find Moses' grave, perhaps I could find the staff. And some of the books that now no longer appear in the Bible, such as the first and second book of Maccabees, which I think are still found in the Catholic Bible,
yes,
but they're not in the Protestant one.
Yes.
They are, aren't they? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically, cutting a long story short, tell us that Moses was buried at the same place that the Ark of the Covenant was made. And the Ark of the Covenant was made at the mountain of God, Horeb, which is the mountain where Moses first speaks to God in the burning bush. And Horeb is also known as Mount Sinai or Mount Sinai. These names are all three separate names, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, the mountain of God, throughout the Bible, or different names given to one and the same place, as where Moses first communes with God. And it's more commonly known today as Mount Sinai. Now, this, according to the popular tradition, is in southeastern Egypt. It's a place called Jebel Musa. And below it, there is a monastery called St. Catherine's Monastery. But it doesn't tell us in the Bible that this is where Mount Sinai is. This was only really determined by the dream of the mother of the Roman emperor who set up the Roman Catholic Church, Emperor Constantine the Great, in 325 AD. So we don't know that is Mount Sinai. But the Bible clearly tells us that Mount Sinai is where the ark was hidden. It is also, as I say, called Mount Horeb. Now, there are two references in the Old Testament for Moses using the staff to bring forth a miraculous stream. While the Israelites are wandering the desert, they're dying of thirst. So Moses strikes his staff against the rock and a miraculous spring comes forth. Now, in the one particular account, it doesn't tell us where this is. But in another account, it tells us that it takes place at a place called Kadesh. And Kadesh was a ravine that goes into what was known as the Valley of Edom, which at the time of the Romans, a great city was built called Petra, which is in southern Jordan. And so I decide to go there because somewhere there, it seems, is where Moses might have been buried and where his staff might have ended up. When I actually got to the entrance to Kadesh, which is now called the Seek, which is this winding, narrow gorge. In fact, it appears in the Indiana Jones film, yep, The Last Crusade. It's where he finds the Grail, strangely enough.
Yeah, yeah. And they use the city of Petra and the
companions riding through this narrow gorge. That's this real place at Petra in southern Jordan. And right at the entrance where Moses, according to the Bible, is supposed to have struck his staff to create this miraculous stream, is a Bedouin shrine called Ein Musa, the spring of Moses. And inside you've got this little spring and a bath in which people collect holy water, and there's a rock there which is supposed to be the very rock that Moses struck. In other words, although scholars had seemingly totally ignored this as the whereabouts of the mountain of God, Mount Horeb, at the bottom of which is Moses' sacred spring, the local Bedouin people have known about it for years. Yeah. And have got this shrine there. So somewhere in this valley, which you enter by going through this gorge, must be the mountain of God. And at one end of it is Mount Hor. On top of that is where Moses' brother Aaron is said to be buried, and there's a shrine to that there. And a mountain at the other end is called Jebel Madaba, and there are many aspects about that that really do match the topography of Mount Sinai as described in the Bible. So it was there, it seems, that Moses may have been buried, and hopefully his staff with him.
And to be able to find this, to be able to go through all of the biblical texts, even like you were just saying a minute ago, apocryphal biblical texts, there are only really, I'd probably have a few people that would smack me in the face right now, but if I'm not mistaken, there are only three officially, like, authorized versions of the Catholic Bible, New Jerusalem Bible, the New American Bible, and I cannot remember what the last one is for the life of me, but yes, they include all of the books like Maccabees, things like that, that were taken out, Bell and the Dragon. They, of course, don't include a lot of the things like Book of Enoch, stuff like that, that were taken out by the Jewish faith whenever Orthodox Judaism came about, like, and even then, to know that some of these stories were omitted by that faith is really interesting to consider. Do you think that it would be the fact that they were trying to continue to hide this information, or just something that was an unconsidered loss to history?
Well, I think different. See, to start off with, there were what we call the Old Testament are a collection of ancient Hebrew and Judaic scriptures known collectively as the Tanakh. And they include far more than what was just in the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
When the Bible, as we now know it, was basically created on behalf of the Emperor Constantine in the 320s, when he decided to make Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And so he got his, like, right-hand man, Eusebius, to kind of go through all these different ancient Judaic plus Christian texts. I mean, there's the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, for example, tell the story of Jesus in the New Testament. There are dozens more that the Catholic Church denied existed for years until in the 1940s, a series of early Gospels, such as the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas, even a Gospel of Judas, were found hidden in a cave in the near the Dead Sea, which proved that there were many other accounts of Jesus's life.
Yeah.
So Eusebius basically said, well, we're going to have four of them, which are pretty similar. And the same kind of went for the Old Testament. Well, we want to build up a kind of background to who Jesus was and where he fits into history. And these are the ones that we want. And later, when the Protestant church came around in the 1500s and broke into many different factions, and you've got Lutherans, you've got eventually Baptist, Methodist, the Church of England, a lot of them, they all had different versions of the Bible. They said, well, we don't want that bit. That doesn't fit in with what we do. We don't want that bit. So this is how that came about. I don't necessarily think that anybody decided to take out the Book of Maccabees because it revealed where the ark was.
No.
It just has things in it that didn't necessarily agree with Protestant view of Christianity as it began to change in the 1500s.
Yeah.
But anyway, going back to the fact that this mountain, Jebel Madaba, that rises above the shrine where Moses is supposed to have struck his staff. I said there were features that are very similar to how the Bible describes the mountain of God. For example, when Moses first leads the Hebrews there, they camp in a valley below at the bottom of the mountain. And we're told that they are first they're overwhelmed by hearing the sound, as it were, of a trumpet exceedingly loud, like an angel playing a trumpet.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, when you stand in this gorge that I was telling you about, that Indiana Jones rides through, at the other end of it, there is this strange effect of the wind, if it's blowing in the right direction, that resonates through the rocks. And all I can say is it sounds like a bizarre cacophony of Buddhist prayer horns. I actually heard it myself. It's kind of, and it's really loud. And that could have been what is described in the Bible as a trumpet exceedingly loud. There are other things on the, there's something really interesting about when the ancient Israelites, some of the elders go halfway up the mountain with Moses until they reach a terrace where they remain while Moses goes to the summit and receives from God the Ten Commandments and other instructions. This halfway up Mount Jebel Madaba is a terrace. It's an artificial terrace cut into the rock at some point, perhaps as long ago as 3,500 years. And it's basically sandstone that's been leveled into a flat terrace.
Interesting.
We're told that it shone in the sun as if like sapphire stones. Now, sapphires are blue, and all around in the scree surrounding that terrace, archaeologists have found parts of blue polished slate, which would once have covered the terrace, and in the sun would perhaps have shone like sapphire stone. But the interesting thing is, even though the God of the ancient Israelites is supposed to be an invisible God, we are told that the Israelites were amazed when they were there because they saw God standing astride this terrace. Now, how can that be so? Well, when you look at the very early Hebrew translations, it says the feet of God were implanted upon this terrace. And there are two obelisks, two sandstone obelisks, contemporary with the cutting of this terrace. They're made of sandstone. And these two obelisks are known locally by the Bedouin as the feet of God. So could the story about they saw there the feet of God have then turned into, over the years, the story of God standing astride on this terrace? So these are some of the things that really make me think this is the true mountain of God, not the place in eastern Egypt where pilgrims visit today. So where here would Moses have been buried? And that was the next part of my quest.
Well, and what did that lead you to, Graham?
Well, I took a long time. My hometown is Birmingham, in not the one in Alabama, the Birmingham in the center of England. It's England's second biggest city. It's not that famous. Most people in America know of places like Liverpool because of the Beatles, or Manchester because of Manchester United. But they're much smaller cities than Birmingham, which is huge. And it's really got many museums and galleries, and it's got one of the biggest libraries in the country, and it's got huge sections on archaeology. Now, the reason being that Birmingham grew up during the Industrial Revolution at a time when there was a new echelon of society, basically entrepreneurs and industrialists. Before that, it was either peasants or aristocrats. Now you've got this middle class, or that became even richer than the aristocrats, people who had made their money in coal mining, building steam engines, and the Industrial Revolution. And the heart of the Industrial Revolution and the growth of this new upper echelon of society was Birmingham. It's actually known as the Black Country because, or parts of it are, because all the buildings were turned black by the soot coming out of hundreds and hundreds of chimneys of all the factories that were there. Now, these rich aristocrats wanted to make a name for themselves, and they started sponsoring the new archaeologists of the mid-19th century to go off to places like India and Egypt and all over the world, China, collecting ancient artifacts so they could show them off in their newly built stately homes. So Birmingham Library has got in here volume after volume of works by these mid-19th century archaeologists. And amongst all this lot, so I'm sitting in Birmingham Museum looking through all these books on archaeology from the 19th century, and discovered that Petra was excavated by two British archaeologists in the mid-19th century. And they discovered a cave at the bottom of a monument known as the Coiled Snake, or Snake Monument. Now, this happened to be at the base of Jebel Madaba. And the reason that I suddenly thought, wow, this could be Moses, is because Moses is forever in the Old Testament being associated with snakes, some of which I've mentioned, this staff turning into a snake. It obviously had some great representation to the ancient Israelites that's perhaps now been forgotten. Also in the Bible, we're told, although nobody's supposed to know where he's buried, we're told that Moses is buried against I think the actual words are, he's buried at somewhere called Beth Peor, which means in ancient Hebrew, the place, or Beth actually means house, like Bethlehem means house of bread. Beth Peor actually means house of the snake or place of the snake. So I thought, wow, this coiled snake built carved from sandstone, dating from the same period as these other things that I've mentioned on the mountain itself, could be the sepulcher, the tomb of Moses. Now, these two guys excavated this cave. They didn't find a body inside it, obviously being robbed out in history some point in history. But amongst the rubble in there, they did find one artifact, which I found absolutely gobsmacking when I first read it. It was a staff. They described it as a priestly Egyptian staff, painted black and inscribed with white hieroglyphics. They didn't say what the hieroglyphics said. They simply said it was a white priestly staff. Now, remember, I've already mentioned how Moses' staff could be Egyptian in origin. And, wow, this was it. So I thought, the staff of Moses has been found by these two archaeologists. What happened to it? It took me quite a bit of time. This is around about the year 2000. Quite a bit of time to research through all the documentation in the Birmingham Museum pertaining to these two guys, and found out that ultimately it was sold to various people and ended up in the hands of an archaeologist from America, or a collector of artifacts from America, who decided that he was going to take it back and give it to a museum in New York. Now, I thought, right, so it's going to be in New York. But then when I read the name of the boat, the ship, that this person decided to travel from Britain to New York on, I thought, oh my God, it was the Titanic. So if he had taken this staff with him, which he seemed to have done, it's ended up at the bottom of the Atlantic.
Right?
But it just so happened that the Titanic set sail from Southampton, but it didn't go directly to New York. It stopped off in Ireland to pick up some more passengers. And at the last minute, and for reasons best known to himself, this guy plus his family decided to stop off for a little holiday, driving holiday around Ireland for a couple of days before taking another boat to New York. And they survived the Titanic. They went on it when it collided with the iceberg and sank. So I thought, wow, so what happened to it then? And this is what becomes even more bizarre. Another strange coincidence, serendipity, synchronicity, whatever you want to call it, is that it was ultimately sold to, it stayed in Britain. It ultimately was sold, or stayed in the British Isles, came back to England, and was ultimately sold to the Birmingham Museum, where apparently it was still on display. From where I was sitting in the Birmingham Library, the Egyptian gallery of the Birmingham Museum was right opposite me, on the opposite side of a square called Victoria Square, about 50 yards away. So there I was, wow, having traveled half the world looking for this thing, and it turns out that it might be 50 yards away from where I was researching.
Yeah, quite literally.
So I literally
in
raced down the stairs, across the Victoria Square, up the stairs of the museum, into the Egyptian gallery, and there it was, this same staff that was found in Petra by these two guys in the 1800s. In a glass case, matching exactly their description. And the hieroglyphics that are on the staff say that it had belonged to somebody called Tutmosis, who was chamberlain to the queen. Now, that basically means, I mean, some people translate it as butler. No, this person wasn't somebody who waited on the queen. This was somebody who advised the queen. And from what we can gather from the Bible and a few other early writings about Moses, this is exactly his position at court. And, okay, it's Tutmosis, not Moses, but Tutmosis, the Moses bit means son, and yep. The Tut bit means the god Thoth. If Moses did become part of the Israelite religion, he would have only believed in one god. He would have dropped the Tut bit, or Thoth, from his name. He may have been named as simple Moses. So the staff of Moses, as far as I'm concerned, still is on public display in the Birmingham Museum in the middle of England, exactly where I lived.
Wow. And then to know that even the possibility of connection of those things is absolutely mind-blowing. And like you said, to know that it had been there the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, the Birmingham Museum didn't, they acquired it in the 1950s, and they'd got no, they hadn't got any kind of documentation, apart from the people who owned it, exactly where it had come from. It was me who produced it all and showed them. Mm. And I said, look, in order to verify that this may have been belonged to Moses, we've got to actually acquire, make sure that it does in fact date from the time Moses is said to have existed, which was somewhere between 1300 and 1350 BC, based on a whole set of things that are mentioned in the Bible. So can we have it carbon dated? But they refused. They said, no way, it'll damage it too much. And there's been a number of documentaries made about this that I've done for the National Geographic Channel, the Smithsonian Channel, a number of, TV channels that are well-respected. And they said, we'll pay to have this done. Surely you want to know how old this thing is, you know?
Nah.
And they said, oh, no. And people said, why won't they carbon date it? Well, to me, the answer is probably that if it turned, I mean, it could be a Victorian fake. These two guys could have just basically said, well, let's fake a staff and sell it to some rich guy. There was a big demand for.
Oh, absolutely.
For ancient artifacts from Egypt in the 19th century. There still is. So it could be a Victorian fake. All the research that I've done suggests that it isn't. But if, on the one hand, it turns out to be a Victorian fake, they've got a useless artifact on their hands. If, on the other hand, it turns out to date from the right period, it's along with all the other evidence I've been talking about, there's a good chance that myself, not a professional archaeologist, or a professional historian attached to a university, has found out something that they didn't know, and it makes them look pretty silly. So kind of what have we got to gain from actually having the thing carbon dated? So I believe that's why they won't have it done. Well, not while I'm alive anyway.
And, We talk so often on this show, Graham, about the literal religion of science. And I got no problem with religion. I mean, I spent my first year in college as a seminarian. You know, religion's a great thing, and when taken in moderation, as my spiritual director used to say. But when you get to the point that your mind is so cemented that you are not willing to accept evidence to the contrary because it may, quote, crush a paradigm, or it may cause a kerfuffle in what we know as history, To me, the answer is good. Like, we need to go down that rabbit hole. We need to investigate that. Not too long ago, we did an episode on Shakespeare and the Shakespeare authorship controversy. And one of the questions that we had from a friend of the show was, why? Why does it matter? Why does it matter? And it's like, well, it matters because it's history.
Well, in the case of Shakespeare, I actually read a book about Shakespeare called The Shakespeare Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. The word conspiracy then, this is going back into the 1990s, was not a dirty word.
No.
I mean, a conspiracy is simply a group of people getting together to try and cover something up or make something seem as if it isn't or whatever.
If they didn't now exist, there's a lot of people that need to be let out of prison, and there's going to be a whole lot of, you know, like district attorneys that are out of jobs.
Precisely. Well, the conspiracy in the case of Shakespeare I investigated was the conspiracy amongst scholars, not religious types this time, mm-hmm. scholars to make Shakespeare out to be a much nicer character than the historical documents seem to suggest. The historical documents seem to suggest he was a drunk, he got involved in fights. He wasn't religious. He was he basically was fairly mean with his money. And yet the way that academics have portrayed Shakespeare over the years was this kindly man who loved his wife and went to church and, you know, never did a bad thing in his life. Well, to me, that just didn't click with the kind of the way that most artistic geniuses are, whether they're writers, musicians, painters. You know, most of them are either drug addicts, completely bonkers. They're certainly bohemian or different, or that they wouldn't come up with these new and innovative ideas.
Yeah.
But if you look at the documentation, I mean, Shakespeare was supposed to be loved by everybody that knew him as a writer. In Stratford-upon-Avon, again in central England, everything seems to be central England. Again, Stratford-upon-Avon.
It's almost like the world revolves around England.
Maybe that's why I ended up here, although I was born here. It's not as I came here to investigate this stuff. Some people say the only reason you keep finding things in central England is because you can't be bothered to go anywhere else.
There's a ton there.
I certainly can't go any much further now. We've got COVID.
There's more than enough there to investigate is what's wild.
Well, I think there is. I mean, you've also got Robin Hood and you've got King Arthur legends here. You've got the lot. But the interesting thing about Shakespeare is in Stratford-upon-Avon, I mean, there's a whole host of stuff to show that people in Stratford did not recognize him as a playwright in his time. The most important being that When you go to the church where he's buried, Holy Trinity Church, there's a grave saying here lies William Shakespeare, etc. And above it, you've got this bust of him on the wall, his monument, his memorial, which shows the balding, bearded playwright we all know and love,
sure,
wearing Elizabethan clothes, and in his hand he's got a feather pen and he's writing on parchment. Or paper. Now, the thing is, everyone says, well, if he wasn't known as a writer and respected as a writer in Stratford-upon-Avon, surely they wouldn't have depicted him like that. So I thought, that's a good point. But then I looked into the historical documentation to discover that this particular memorial was only put there in 1744 by a theatrical agent.
Wow.
The original had crumbled and needed repairing. So this theatrical guy who wanted to start a Shakespeare theatre in Stratford said, oh, well, I'll pay for it to be done. And he had it done in the way that we know it today. But luckily, earlier drawings do survive of what the original monument looks like. And it shows a different looking, thinner person with his hands on a sack, showing that William Shakespeare, I mean, these memorials showed the person's trade. So the one now shows him as a writer. but the original showed him as a dealer in bagged commodities. And if you look at all the writings about Shakespeare at the time that still survive in Stratford, it talks about him buying land on which to buy wheat and barley, selling malt and grain. He basically sold grain to the brewery industry.
Yeah, there is not a single there is not a single document showing a payment to William Shakespeare as a from a patron for writing anything.
Well, as a writer, and he must have been pretty prolific writing a whole host of plays. When you remember, he has to write these with a pen and paper, a feather pen, and then he's going to make mistakes, so he's got to rub them out, screw up his paper, start again. It would have taken years. I mean, I wrote my first two books before they actually had word processors. Yeah. And because I couldn't type then, and in fact, the typewriter I had didn't have the letter T and E in it. So I thought I had to write a book without the letters T and E, which would have been quite complicated.
You've got to be real creative.
I'd have to be real creative. But anyway, so I wrote them literally out by hand, and there was a lady I knew who did the typing for me. And it takes forever. I wouldn't do it now. I wouldn't have even started writing books. But anyway, can imagine Shakespeare with a scratchy pen and not very good paper in those days. It would have taken him years to write these books and a lot of time. So it had pretty much a full-time job. And he was acting at the Globe Theatre and other theatres. Yep. And he was producing and he was directing his plays. I mean, he hadn't time for anything else. Yet all the records in Stratford-upon-Avon show that he was a vet. And they didn't get much money for this, about the equivalent of £5 for a play, which, okay, that'd be a good few hundred pounds these days. But it wasn't much. And in London, he was living in squalid accommodation. This is all he could afford. But in Stratford-upon-Avon, he buys the second biggest house in the town, a place fit for a lord. He buys hundreds of acres of land where he can grow his wheat and barley for the malt, for the brewery trade. He lends large sums of money at exactly the same time as he's being sought by authorities in London for not paying paltry sums of money for his rent. And his taxes. I mean, he's leading at the very least some strange double life. But all these things about Stratford, about William Shakespeare, is not what the theatrical community and the academic community want us to know.
Yes.
Shakespeare was a genius. There's no doubt whoever wrote those plays, whether it was the same William Shakespeare or whoever wrote those plays was a genius. And he not only really wrote some wonderful plays, he thought up the whole modern concept of theatre, which also ultimately became the movie industry. Yes. If it wasn't for Shakespeare, we may not have television now, for all I know.
An amazing poet as well.
And he was an amazing poet. And the thing is that because the academic community, particularly in Victorian times, wanted to portray Shakespeare as pretty much the patron saint of the English language. Britain was conquering the world. It ruled half the world, the greatest empire the world had ever known. And people wanted to say, well, Shakespeare is the father of the English language, as the patron saint of the English language. He must have been a really great guy. I mean, he couldn't have been some drunkard, somebody. In fact, all he left his wife in his will was his second best bed. I mean, who's the first best bed for?
Yeah.
I mean, he was clearly an adulterer or something. I mean, all these things they don't want you to know. They don't want school kids to know all this. So they portray Shakespeare as this wonderful man who one day set off with a pack on his back and went to London and became a playwright, made loads of money, was good to the people of Stratford and so on. And it just wasn't like that. And also, when you look into it, you are told that Shakespeare was born just a few days ago from today, actually, the 23rd of April.
Yep.
He died on the 23rd of April. You know what day that is? St. George's Day, the patron saint of England.
Wow.
It's got to tell you something.
Interesting.
So anyway, the Shakespeare conspiracy was basically this whole conspiracy, particularly in Victorian times, and still going today, to make Shakespeare this character that he wasn't. And in fact, when my book came out, it got vast amounts of publicity. And one newspaper described me as the worst kind of Philistine. And another one described me as an enemy of the arts. And the Shakespeare Centre in Stratford-upon-Avon even banned me from going in. And the security guard had a picture of me underneath the desk. So I had to literally go in with a false beard. Oh, I've got your back.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
What happened there?
Apparently, we had a little bit of a problem with our device here. So I'm back. We're here. Sorry about that, folks. I was responding to the fact that your work is so broad, so vast. And even like you were just saying, going into the topic of the lost history of Shakespeare, most of your work deals in lost history and misunderstood history. But when you start talking about things like the Templars, the Ark of the Covenant, like you were saying a minute ago, there are so many different stories about the staff of Moses, the death of Moses, where it might be. What were some of the things that you started coming across when going into your research on the Ark of the Covenant and the Templar connection?
Yeah, well, as I've already mentioned, the Mountain of God is not only where it seems that Moses was buried, but also where the Ark of the Covenant ended up. And this is what we're told in this the second book of Maccabees, one of the books we were talking about that had been taken out of the Protestant Bible. Now, it was apparently with some other artifacts hidden in a cave. Now, if that cave was at the Mountain of God, which in my research was Jebel Madaba in Petra, I thought, well, okay, is that buried somewhere? I mean, the Ark of the Covenant was basically supposed to have been a golden chest about, I don't know, four feet long, 3 feet wide, 3 feet deep, that was carried by two poles put through rings on the side of it by the priests. Its power was supposed to be kind of a radio for talking to God. In other words, when the high priest stood next to it, the voice of God could be heard by the priest. Whether or not that means the priest went off into some sort of trance-like state and spoke as God, or if an actual voice spoke from it, we're not really told. But the Ark is also supposed to have had kind of like what you'd probably describe today as high-powered lasers that came out of it.
It was and like a blasted, weapon of mass destruction.
A weapon of mass destruction. It is basically, I suppose, you could say that Moses' staff was the first weapon of mass destruction. This was the second. Yeah. But this was made by Moses and the Israelites after
ordered
he came down from the Mountain of God.
Ordered
with
to
the
be
instruction
made by God.
About. Say again?
Ordered to be made by God.
Ordered to be made by God to specific instructions.
Yeah.
And the reason they made it was to hold the two tablets that contained the Ten Commandments that God had inscribed himself from the sandstone on top of the mountain. Now, the Ark is said to have had two angels, golden angels carved onto its hilt, two statues, if you like, of golden angels on its hilt, on its top, on its lid. Most people know what it's supposed to look like through the Indiana Jones films. Now, the interesting thing is that if this was an Egyptian tradition, like I mentioned earlier about how in Tutankhamun's tomb, there is something that looks very much like the Ark. It's a chest. On top of it is a statue of the jackal-headed god Anubis. Now, inside that chest would have been carried around a statue, another holy item, a relic associated with Anubis that was carried from one temple to another, then taken out by the priest so it could be worshipped. It was a kind of mobile artifact moving device, if you like. And this seems to have been what the Ark was, but for moving around the most sacred items that the ancient Israelites possessed, the two tablets carved by God himself. Now, eventually, when the Israelites settled in Jerusalem, they built, or at least at the time of King Solomon, which is around about 3,000 years ago, they built a temple, according to the instructions of God, in which they kept the Ark of the Covenant. That stayed there until the temple was sacked by the Babylonians. I think it was in 597 or 8 BC by King Nebuchadnezzar. He sacked, ruined the temple, robbed out all the artifacts that are in there. But according to the book of second book of Maccabees, a prophet was given instructions by God to move the Ark and a number of other artifacts away from the temple and hide them before the Babylonians turned up. And this is when it was hidden in a cave at the Mountain of God. Now, if this is the mountain in Petra, then did anybody find it? Like these two guys had found this staff in the mid-19th century. Had anybody found the Ark of the Covenant? Interestingly, perhaps during the Crusades, a group of people who were stationed in this area, Petra, to guard it against the Saracens, the Arab armies, were the Knights Templars, warrior monks. And the ones that were there happened to come from England. Once again, don't ask me how, central England, not far from Stratford-upon-Avon. And they had their headquarters, or a presbytery, as it was known, which is a kind of cross between a monastery and a military barracks, at a place called Temple Herdwick, named after them. That's why the temple's in the name. And when the Crusades were lost, and the Saracens, the Arabs, gained control of the whole of the Middle East again, the Templars withdrew, came back to England, and according to a number of medieval documents, they brought back with them certain relics that they had discovered, relics associated with the Bible, they believed, that they discovered at Petra, one of which is described as a large golden chest. It doesn't say the Ark, but the place where they found it would seem to be the very place where the Ark ended up. And in fact, it might have even been, although it wouldn't have exactly looked like it at the time, that very place where Indiana Jones in the film discovers the Holy Grail, that thing cut out into the hillsides known as the Treasury. Now, that is a 2,000-year-old tomb, but there was an earlier a cave, decorated cave there. Now, that could have been where it was. But again, somewhere at the Mountain of God, they found this large golden chest, which is just an inventory of items that they had. Now, if this was the Ark of the Covenant, then it ends up at Temple Herdwick in England. Now, the Templars themselves were eventually outlawed by the Pope in 1307. And a lot of them were burnt at the stake on Friday the 13th of October of that year, which is one of the reasons why Friday the 13th is considered unlucky. the Templars, this little chapel that they had in which they kept these items, including their most prized possession, this golden chest, for many years was a barn. And then it was turned into a private house with parts of the walls still there. But they also built another church on the hill. Now, even though the Templars throughout much of Europe were outlawed in 1307, they survived in England because the English king at the time had fallen out with the Pope, and they survived here for some years until the last of them, which included these few at Temple Herdwick, were wiped out by the Black Death. Now, they knew that the bubonic plague or Black Death was soon going to kill them all off, probably. And when they built this church on top of a hill that overlooks Temple Herdwick, called the Burton Dasset Church, it's the Burton Dasset Hills, on the Burton Dasset Church, legend told that they had secreted clues as to where they had hidden their treasures. Didn't say the ark, but let's say the ark's amongst them, as I believed. Clues as to where the ark had been hidden. Now, in very much the same strange way as much later, the persecuted Catholics of England had hidden these murals behind this panelling at Harvington Hall to lead to the Green Stone, it seems that the Templars had actually boarded up or covered up these paintings on the wall, which was their clues, by plasterwork, which wasn't discovered until the late 1890s. And the man who discovered them was a local archaeologist called Jacob Cove Jones. And he was convinced, I mean, it was the renovators who had suddenly found all these old paintings, and they were dated to the 1350s, when the Black Death had pretty much wiped out the last of the Templars there. And they thought, wow, this is interesting, good historical find. Jacob Cove Jones said, no, these are more than that. They are the clues as to where their Templars. And he believed that this golden chest was the Ark of the Covenant. And he said, this is where they hid the Ark of the Covenant. And he spent some years trying to solve these clues. No one else took him very seriously, particularly his fellow archaeologists. And when he'd worked it out, he sadly discovered that he was dying, and he hadn't got long to live. So rather than go and dig the thing up, especially since nobody else believed him, he decided to leave his own set of clues as to where it was. The reason being is that they didn't have the way of preserving murals on walls back in the late 19th century. And these murals were quickly crumbling. There's hardly anything of them left now. So no one would be able to decipher them in the future. So what he did is he designed a stained glass window, got a friend of his who was an artist to make this stained glass window, and donated it to a small parish church near where he lived that was being built at the time. And that window, according to his family tradition, held the clues as to where one could find where the ark was hidden. Now, I went to this church in a little village called Langley, and when I saw that, I was quite surprised that the window is actually so small. It's only about, I don't know, 5 feet high and about 3 feet wide. But the church is very small. It's one of the smallest churches in England. It's a tiny little place, like a chapel, really. But this stained glass window doesn't depict the Ark of the Covenant. It depicts the three wise men visiting the baby Jesus, and giving him their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, this, the actual event is called by the Christian church Epiphany. And Epiphany is the 12th night of Christmas, which is the 6th of January, I believe, or the 5th. Anyway, the night between them is known as Epiphany Day. Now, I thought, well, if this holds the clues as to the Ark of the Covenant, I mean, does anybody in the family know what they might be? Have they researched it? And I traced Cove Jones's descendants, and they said, well, the man was just a bit crazy. People have tried to solve the clues, but there's no Ark of the Covenant depicted in it, so we don't believe that he ever did. You know, he may have paid for this window to be put there. He may have even designed it and told the glassmaker to put it in the way he designed, but they didn't believe it led to anything. But when I looked at it, the first thing that I noticed was in the middle of the picture is this strange conical shaped object, which is supposed to be one of the three wise men's gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But it's a weird shaped vessel. It's basically a kind of round thing with like castellated or castellated top, like battlements around it. And on top of that is this conical roof. Well, it just so happens that on the top of the Burton Dasset Hills, near the church that had the original Templar murals on the wall, there is something that looks exactly like that. And it's known locally as the Phoenix Beacon. And on this object that seems to be held by one of the three wise men is depicted a phoenix. So I thought, wow, that's actually depicting a thinly disguised local monument. And looking into the history of the Phoenix Beacon, I discovered that it was built by the Templars at the same time as they built the Burton Dasset Church, and it directly overlooks their presbytery, their little chapel, which was for years a barn and then turned into a private house. It directly overlooks it. So I thought, well, maybe it's there, but that didn't seem to lead anywhere. Then I thought, why depict the three wise men on the Epiphany? Well, maybe it's got something to do with that date, the 6th of January. How did the three wise men discover where baby Jesus was to be found? Well, they did that by following a star.
Yep.
Now, stars, in fact, are associated with the Ark of the Covenant. Remember I said there was two angels on the yep. top? They are supposed to be Gabriel and Michael. And Gabriel and Michael are depicted on the walls of amongst the Templar murals on the walls of the Burton Dasset Church. And in ancient Hebrew tradition, the two tail stars of what we now call the Big Dipper or the Great Bear, Binatesh and Mizar, represent, that's what they're called in, that's their Arabic names, but they were originally known as Gabriel and Michael. So in other words, the two tail stars of the Big Dipper or the Plough, as we call it in England, are represented as the, are thought to represent the angels depicted on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And there is a star depicted in the Epiphany window. In fact, two stars, one laid upon the other. And right next to them in the window surround, there is two letters, B and M. And everyone says, well, that's associated with the name of the wise men. Belshazzar, Melchizedek, I think it is. And what are they called again?
Balthazar, Melchizedek, and, oh, God, I have CCE teachers that'd like to slap me right now, Graham.
Something beginning with G, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, the M and the G, the M and the B and the M, they said, oh, represented the names of two of the wise men, the two you just mentioned.
Yeah.
But I thought they could also represent Benetech and Mizar. And right between them, again, is represented a phoenix bird, just like on the vessel that looks like the phoenix beacon. So I thought, is it just possible that on Epiphany, the 6th of January, I am supposed to go to the Phoenix Beacon and observe the two tail stars, Benetech and Mizar, and maybe they point to a location where I can find the where Jacob Cove believes the ark was hidden, in the same way as the star led the wise men to find Jesus. But the thing is, as the night goes by, stars move around as the earth rotates. So what time of night? Well, at the top of the window, there's a picture of a rooster or cockerel. And the early Christian tradition held that when the wise men got to Bethlehem by following the star, the way they actually discovered where Jesus was in the stable, they heard a cock crowing at midnight, which is unusual, and it was crowing right on top of the stable, and that led them to find Jesus. So could this mean that at midnight on the 6th, Epiphany night, if I go to that Phoenix Beacon, I can be given a location by the position of those two stars as to where I have to look? But if I have to look somewhere, what am I looking for? Well, directly below the two stars is depicted a red archway of some kind. So I thought, okay, maybe there's a red arch there, part of a building, who knows? Eventually, going to the top of the beacon, up the top of the Dasset Hills, standing beside the beacon, the Phoenix Beacon, at exactly, in fact, actually, it was all cloudy, so we had to do this by a simulation. You can actually do it now on your phone, but back then, in the late 1990s, we literally had to go to a planetarium at a university to work out where the stars would be. But it's since been up there, seen those two stars. As the night goes on, as you'll see the Big Dipper move around until at exactly 12 o'clock. This is 12 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, not summertime, which it is in the winter. At exactly 12 o'clock, those two stars are almost pointing exactly downwards. And if you draw a line between them, it arrives at a point on the horizon that, if you take a bearing by daytime, you'll see it's right at the bottom of a single hill on the horizon. So next day, going there, what do I find? Right beside the road, you get to a place called Chapel Green. It's called that because a chapel once stood there. And right beside the road is a red brick arch, just like is depicted in the stained glass window below the two stars. And I thought, wow, this is it. But this was a Victorian drinking fountain, but it was there in Jacob Cope Jones' time. So that may have been what he wanted us to examine. But it was built over the site of an ancient holy well. And it had been the holy well of a church that once stood in the adjacent field. We got a geophysics team to come in and examine the area, and it seemed that the actual church wasn't built in the field behind where the holy well was, an old chapel that had been knocked down in the 1950s, and it had stood where the road is now. So when they put the modern road in, they basically dug up the old chapel. So I thought, oh no, where on earth has the ark gone? Did these builders find it? I happened to discover that the head of the building company that laid this new road, that dug up the old church. So there was no protection against old monuments in those days. This guy, after being relatively poor, had bought one of the biggest houses in the entire county. Where did he get the money? Unfortunately, he was long dead and his relatives had scattered all over the world. So who knows what had happened to the Ark of the Covenant? But an interesting footnote is that a lot of the stones that had made up the church were used as rubble to bank up a stream nearby, in a wood nearby. And when searching through what were clearly stones from an old church all against this embankment and around around this little stream, one of the stones that was discovered was a sandstone slab about 18 inches high and wide, and on it was written all this strange writing. It was clearly very old, and experts said that the writing on it was proto-Sinaitic, which is an early form of Hebrew, and the stone was identified as coming from Mount Jebel Madabar. The very mountain, I believe, was the mountain of God.
Wow.
In other words, there's a possibility that what we had found was a broken one of the stones of the Ten Commandments that had once been in the Ark. When these builders found it in the 1950s, the Ark, they thought, that's gold, we'll have that. That's a piece of stone, let's chuck it away. So I could have found one of the Ten Commandments.
Wow. Now, going back to the stained glass window, Graham, I've got it up on screen right now for our internet viewers, things like that to see. And just a couple of things to note, like the kings themselves, like never in any account does it say that they are armed.
No.
The one in the foreground definitely looks as though he is wearing some kind of chainmail, as is does the quote Balthazar with the bee. They definitely look as though they're wearing something similar, almost to a bishop's cloak, and what they wear ceremonially in the Catholic Church. At least in the middle, but even himself right there underneath his crown looks like he has chainmail on.
Well, this is interestingly how the Knights Templars eventually used to dress, except they wouldn't wear crowns.
But sure.
The original Templars were poor Knights of Christ, as they call themselves.
Absolutely.
But as they got more powerful, they got richer, they took wives, they were no longer monks, they had great wealth, and that could represent Templars.
And even down in the lower right-hand corner, if you know, like, there is a crown down on the floor from the, quote, king that is kneeling before Mary and Christ. And right over here in the bottom right-hand corner, almost looks like a church or something like that, which I suppose would be the third gift, you know, from the third king, but almost looks like the entrance to a Gothic cathedral, something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, the unfortunately, we don't know what the church chapel where Cove Jones believed the Ark was hidden actually looked like, because the only photograph I've managed to find of it is when it's still a ruin. But that is an interesting point.
Yeah, and I mean, it just the detail in which this panel in and of itself goes into is just phenomenal. And the decoding that you've done in it, especially, and even over here above the Blessed Virgin Mary, to see the dove and what looks almost like a grail with things spilling out of it.
Well, basically, that dove, I mean, there was much more involved in the search than I've mentioned. But too much to go into now. But that is a dove sitting on top of some kind of basket or some kind of something which seems to have straw in it that's pouring out. It almost looks like water pouring out of a goblet of some kind. Well, something that looks exactly like that we visited as part of the search is called Dove Bridge. And there's a dove on top of it. And there are loads of things in that picture helped us to follow through with this quest.
Now, what was it that you finally came to when... What were the conclusions that you came to in your quest, Graham? Did you find the Ark? Was it like you said that this construction company may have run across it back many, many years ago?
Well, that actually is all part of a book I'm working on at the moment, because the construction worker who then built this big house got so much money that he bought an old Elizabethan building nearby called Guy's Cliff. It can be found near the town of Warwick. And it was a ruin, but it still had attached to it an old medieval chapel. He converted that chapel into what local people called a Masonic meeting hall. Now, they weren't Masons, they weren't Freemasons, because they called themselves the Order of the Rose Cross. And the Rose Cross, or the Rosicrucians, is a group that exists. Well, there are many versions of Rosicrucians throughout the world, but they believe themselves to be descended from the Knights Templars.
Indeed.
Why should a simple builder suddenly become interested in founding his own Masonic-like lodge called the Order of the Rose Cross, or the Rosicrucians? And that is where my investigations have been. I mean, for a long, long time, after this guy died in the 19... Well, basically, until he died relatively recently, you couldn't get anywhere near the place. No one would let you in, no, whatever. People said, oh, these robe figures turn up at night and do all sorts of weird stuff. We tried to sneak in there, and it was surrounded by sensors. Lights came on. There's barbed wire. It's ridiculous. Eventually, when this guy eventually died, it was donated to the Freemasons of Warwickshire. So they all, because it's so big inside, they divided it into three separate Masonic meeting halls, and they all share it together and pay for its upkeep. They don't know hardly anything about this guy, and the person who looks after it today is very, very interested in knowing about this history of the Ark, and he lets us go there at any time. So I was going to really explore the place last summer, but basically because of COVID, it couldn't be done. So I'm hoping to do it in a few weeks when Britain opens up again.
Yeah, and, you know, we were kind of talking about that pre-show, things like that. What has that done for your, not only for your research, the world of COVID, things like that, but what has it also done for your writing, Graham?
Well, it's allowed me to write a lot more because I'm stuck indoors. But as for actually going out and doing research, it's put a complete stop to it. I mean, I basically spent half my time traveling all over the place doing this research, the other half writing it. Well, I've been able to do twice as much writing in the last year. So really, I'm probably going to do twice as much traveling around.
Just to make up for lost time.
Make up for lost time.
Well, see, like, I know myself, I have my headpiece to the staff of Ra, so whenever things clear up, I'm going to be going out and searching for the Ark myself.
Is that the thing like Indiana Jones puts on the top of his stick?
That's right. I am such a nerd, Graham. If you look over my shoulder, you'll see the Holy Grail as well.
Oh, yeah.
But
oh, brilliant. I've got one of them.
And, you know, there are so many theories about the final fate of the Ark of the Covenant, whether it is in Africa at a Templar church, whether it was given to a class of priests in Africa to guard, whether it is actually here in the American West, or whether it's in Oak Island.
Well, the story about it ending up in Ethiopia and Africa comes from the fact that they have a tradition, the Ethiopian church, that when Solomon built the temple to house the ark, he had two sons, and one of these, they basically fell out with each other, and and ancient Israel split into two, Israel proper in the north and Judea in the south, surrounding Jerusalem. And the person who was on the losing side, I believe, or the side that lost Jerusalem, one of the brothers decided to make an exact replica of the ark, put it in the temple, and take the real one away when he fled the country and went to Ethiopia. And it's that which the Ethiopian church believe was the real ark that they keep in a church there. Now, researchers that have been there searching for it have got as far as to where it is, and they've got some guy standing outside saying, yeah, we've got it here. Can I see it? No, no one can see it apart from us. So there's no real proof that they've got an ark. But if they do have, then there's two arcs. They say that that's an original and a copy. And so the one that stayed in the Temple of Jerusalem and was eventually hidden at the Mountain of God is a replica. But to be quite honest, you know, I'm not myself convinced about the Ethiopian story. There's nowhere in the Bible does it suggest this, and there are no ancient Israelite writings or Hebrew or Judaic writings that say it ends up in Ethiopia. That's purely an Ethiopian tradition. The story of it ending up in Oak Island or anywhere in America comes from the fact that a number of researchers believe that some of the Knights Templars, when they were being persecuted in Europe, sailed to America. Now, it's possible. Columbus wasn't the first one to discover the Americas. The Vikings were. That's and right. They'd done that a good 300 years or so before the Templars could have sailed there. They did it by island hopping from what the Vikings did, Britain, Iceland, Greenland, across to Canada, down the coast. So it could have been done. And so they could have ended up in Canada if the Knights Templars had it. And that's where that theory comes into it. But as for the money pit, this Oak Island thing, it's a fascinating story, but how far down are they going to, I mean, if you're going to hide something, why put it down about, I don't know, how deep is that thing?
Well, and you know, I know that quite a few people that typically listen to the show, honestly, during the Curse of Oak Island, don't listen to the show live on Tuesdays. So starting next week will be an influx of listeners. Even my wife is addicted to the Curse of Oak Island. Like, I lose out my wife to the Curse of Oak Island.
Well, I know you seem to keep finding everything out. The suggestions that there's original Shakespeare manuscripts.
Oh, yeah.
Down there.
Yeah. Preserved in mercury, like all kinds of things.
It's like everything from every time is there. I mean, it's certainly a fascinating construction. I mean, that they built this great big pit with these channels that go to the sea. I mean, whoever built it, it's something quite remarkable. I really haven't researched that one. There's too many other people doing it.
It's out there. It really is. And it's one of those, Graham, that for me, like I keep telling people, whether or not they find gold, whether they find silver, whether they find lost Templar artifacts or, you know, the booty from King Solomon's temple, what have you, what they are finding is history.
Well, I think
history.
It started off as the search for Captain Morgan's treasure, didn't it?
The treasure that they are finding is history. That's the treasure that they're finding, is the truth of what happened on Oak Island. Whether it's gold, silver, lost, like, I don't care if it's the hidden body of Jesus Christ. What they're finding right now is amazing points of history that have never been known.
Well, and it's almost as if somebody dug that great big thing years and years ago, put some item from that particular period of time in there. Later on, somebody from a later period of time put something else, and they just keep doing it. So it is strata of history.
Yeah. And it's just, it's amazing. And even the Templar cross that David Brody, go check it out on the Dudes and Beer group, Graham. I know you're a member. Check it out from David Brody. We just had a great episode with him on the Knights Templar. And to know that, like, yeah, that's up there in the Hudson Valley, stuff like that. Like, it is straight up a Templar cross on a stone.
Wow. I'll listen to that one.
And of course, there is the theory that the lost tribe of Israel may have come over to the American Southwest, and that is where the Ark of the Covenant is finally lying.
Well, you know, actually, there are not just one tribe of Israel lost. Yeah. There were nine. No, a ten. Because there was 12 tribes, two of them ended up as the tribe of Judah in Judea, plus the Levites, and all the other 10, no one knows what happened to them.
Yeah, one of them was actively obliterated by the order of God. It was like, those guys have just strayed too far, you need to just go kill them.
Oh, those are the ones that Moses had to get rid of, are they?
Yeah, yeah. It was like, they just gotta go.
I think when Moses was at the top of the mountain, one of the Ten Commandments that God gives him is, thou shalt not kill. And when he comes down and finds them all worshipping a golden calf, God then orders him to kill all these people who are doing it.
Yeah.
Something either has got lost in translation or it's not quite right now.
Don't kill unless I tell you to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Graham, the research that you have done over the last decades is so vast, so incredible, so absolutely mind-blowing. Some of the things that you have found, like you said, the Staff of Moses, even the connection to the Greenstone, things like that. It's so amazing. I cannot wait until the new books come out. What can we be looking forward to? Is it anything that you can give us a teaser about? Anything that we should be looking forward to?
Well, I'm doing something about, basically, the book I mentioned earlier about looking into where the ark might have ended up includes all sorts of weird stuff that happened when we were involved in that research. It involves parallel universes. It involves the story of Alice in Wonderland, occult magicians, Dracula. Now, that might sound crazy, and people say, oh, he's gone completely mad now. But it hangs together.
Yeah. And
so I don't even know what I'm going to call it yet.
Well, once again, your body of work is so vast, so wide, so big. I love reading it. Tell everybody where they can go. It's time for shameless self-promotion before we let you go and before we end the show. So tell them where they can go other than the Dudes and Beer store to buy your books, to support your work, to check out the vast number of documentaries that you have been in and shows like Ancient Aliens and things like that.
Well, if you go to my website, people still go to websites these days, or is it all Facebook?
God, I hope so, man, because I shamelessly promote mine.
Oh, well, fair enough. My website is Graham Phillips, as you'll see spelt. Yeah, you can see it there. GrahamPhillips.net, not .com, .net. Just imagine me with a net on my head and you won't forget. GrahamPhillips.net. Now, there's a first page on that you come to, and there's pictures of most of my books. Just click on any of those, and I'll give a full story about what they're all about. I'm not, you know, you don't even have to read the books, to be quite honest. You can see a potted version of it there with pictures and everything. That's really, I'd do it to be journalist friendly so that any journalist can look at it and say, oh, that's what his story is about. We'd have to read the whole thing. So go on there. Also, there's links there to my Facebook if you want to join that at the top of the page, links to Facebook, my IMBD, is it called? Which has got a DB. List of INDB.
Internet Movie Database, owned by Amazon.
Right. That's what it stands for. For a person who's been doing this for years, I should know more, really, especially the name of the third wise man.
Anyway, hey man, I used to teach religion and spirituality. You'd think I'd know the name of the third wise man.
But if you go to, if you'd want to see my videos, my YouTube channel, just type into Google Graham Phillips author YouTube so you don't get me confused with other Graham Phillipses. Graham Phillips author YouTube. And then you will see the different, you'll see all films that I've made myself about all sorts of things, some of the TV stuff I've been in and everything.
Absolutely. And
if you want to find me, just type in Graham Phillips author. There's a few other Graham Phillipses in the world who have done a few things. One of them went out with Ariana Grande, and a lot of people think that's me.
You should just, you know, you should just say yes. Yes, that's me.
Well, kind of. I mean, when people say, oh, you went out with Ariana Grande, I don't say no.
Yeah, you know, kind of. Yeah, you know, I guess.
I just forgot.
If you want to call it going out, you know. Graham, once again, thank you so much for the time, as always. The realm of knowledge that you have on these topics is so vast, so incredible, and I cannot wait until the new book comes out, and I cannot wait until your next appearance. Thank you so much again.
Well, thank you very much indeed, too.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online checking out everything from our guest tonight, Graham Phillips, make sure to go on by the Dudes and Beer Podcast. DudesandBeerPodcast.com is where you can find everything. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by HC Universal Network. That is, of course, our parent network, full of great content. Yes, but why podcast if you enjoy things about comedy, improv, if you like horror, stuff like that, check out the Scary Dad podcast. Check out the Talking Sound podcast if you like that. Until next time, take care of yourselves.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast.
Talk to you soon.
To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.